Hello, everybody. I'm John Arola. This is the Damage Report. Thank you for being with us on this, a Tuesday that will bring stuff. We're gonna see what happens behind the scenes. If you're watching this live, you know that we're starting a little bit late. We're having a little bit of technical problems, but we are working on it. So I will promise you this. We will talk about some news and a show of some sort will happen. I make no promises beyond that. We're gonna have to see what form it actually comes in. We are trying to resolve the technical problems so that the always awesome Senator Nina Turner can join us. Right now, we're not there. You're stuck with me. Apologies in advance. But what I can say is that over the course of the next, we'll say 85 minutes or so, we are gonna talk about a lot of news. We've got multiple updates on what was going on in and around the White House in the run up to inauguration this year on January 6th and around it. I have some thoughts about the late way that this information is coming out. So we'll be talking about that. Things are going very poorly for Joe Biden, poorly for Kamala Harris as well. So we're gonna be talking about that. What could potentially change that situation? Tucker Carlson's a big old creep. So that'll be fun. One of the weirdest things I've ever seen on his show. We're gonna try to figure out what the hell's going on there. We've got bad teachers, we've got bad people in media, we've got bad politicians, it's all bad. So thank you for being with us. We also are gonna be doing Meanwhile In to close out the episode, news from around the world and actually outside of the world. So I'm always happy when we can leave the gravity well and talk about some news from outside of our orbit. But with all that, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button, sharing the stream, can't hurt. Considering that we're starting late. And if you wanna send us comments, tweets, super chats, all that, we will respond to those as we go. But with that said, Sophie, should we launch into some news? She doesn't know, but she's gonna be doing commentary. I'm kidding. Anyway, let's talk about what's going on. It's been a while since January 6th, and you know, we've talked about it many times on the show. You might think that a lot has been revealed, but remember, there are books to be written by journalists, so they sit on stuff constantly. We've got the January 6th commission, which theoretically is supposed to be able to find something if literally anyone they subpoena ever complies with their subpoenas. But that said, if the second of those two possibilities for finding out more about the 6th doesn't come through, at least the first seems like it is, because we've got some revelations for you. The first is this, on New Year's Eve, Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff at that point, emailed a memo to a top aide to Vice President Mike Pence outlining how the vice president could overturn Biden's November electoral win. And I know what you're thinking. No, wait, we already knew about this, all the stuff with Pence and all that. No, this is a different kooky, harebrained whack job idea of how they could stop Biden from becoming president. You know, previously we have the Eastman memo, which we found out more about. It fits on a little a post-it note basically, and it gives you a 7-point plan to ending democracy. This is a different one. Okay, so in the memo, and this is according to, by the way, as a lot of these things are, Jonathan Carl of ABC News, his book is coming out soon. He says Jenna Ellis listed, so it's Jenna Ellis. So right off the bat, buckle up. Anyway, she listed a clear strategy for Pence to contest the results, which would have involved the vice president on January 6th sending back the electoral votes of 6 competitive states that Trump said he won. So you can already see that there's a little bit of substantive overlap with the Eastman idea, but this is slightly different. It involves a time limit. The plan outlined that Pence would then issue a deadline of 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on January 15th. For states to return an updated vote total. According to Ellis's plan, if any state legislature failed to provide vote totals by the deadline, then electoral votes would not be open and counted from that particular state. In such a case, neither Biden nor Trump would have compiled a majority of votes, which Ellis said would mean that Congress should vote by state delegation, a move that would have aided Trump since Republicans controlled a majority of congressional delegations. So the like particular mechanism for it, and certainly the timeline, is different than the Eastman memo, but some of the like broad strokes are similar. It involves Mike Pence taking his always as VP ceremonial role of certifying the results, which means looking at a pile of them and saying good job. That is all he's supposed to do. Then something happens, and in the end, Republicans who control a majority of state delegations would have just chosen Trump as their president. There would have been not even a pretense of anything even distantly related to democracy in any of this, but Jenna Ellis thought that it could work. And they were doing a lot of pressure. This is a full court press on Mike Pence to get him to go along with this. On January 1st, a day after that memo was sent, Trump's aide John McEntee relayed another memo to Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff, entitled, quote, "Jefferson used his position as VP to win," which isn't true. It's not historically accurate, but they thought it was convincing. So look, this is very similar, as we said, in some ways to the Eastman thing. But the reason that I think it's important that we know about this is you need to know how broad this effort was, that involved multiple different aides, multiple legal representatives, as well as the chief of staff himself. This is Mark Meadows communicating directly to Mike Pence. Now, Mark Meadows, you might remember, is one of the guys who, after Steve Bannon, defied the subpoena of the January 6th commission. And as of yesterday, when Steve Bannon had turned himself in, some of the congressional Democrats said, we are preparing the same thing for Mark Meadows if necessary, if we actually need that. And so, you know, that's useful to have. Mark Meadows was chief of staff. He talked quite a bit with Trump. It would be very interesting to hear what he thought was going on in those weeks. But if Mark Meadows himself was involved in the effort to pressure Mike Pence to end democracy in America, all the more reason that we should have his testimony and potentially documents as well. Because Carl is talking here, you know, about Mark Meadows having done that. At least as of what I've seen, we don't have the actual text of that memo. We don't have the responses that might have come from either Pence or one of his representatives, but all of that conceivably does exist. If it doesn't, then that's probably breaking the law. They're not supposed to be deleting those sorts of messages, but we'll have to see. And why does this matter? Because this was the strategy, not just for the legal representatives, the aides, or even the chief of staff. Trump was involved in this. And he was trying for close to 2 months before January 6th to get people fired up for the possibility that all of this is gonna come down to Pence and he's gonna be the one. You might recall, we covered it at the time, when Senators David Perdue, then Senators David Perdue, and Kelly Loeffler were running in their runoffs for Georgia Senate. There was a rally that Trump went to, and supposedly it was about them, but Trump didn't really care about that. And he said at one point, I hope Mike Pence comes through for us. I have to tell you, I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much. Now, if I had to choose between the then president of the United States talking about how he'd like me less if I didn't do some nonsensical thing that has no relationship to the Constitution and ends democracy in America, I would prefer that to him sending his acolytes screaming for my blood through the halls of Congress. But remember, this is one of the first steps. Before we got to Trump doing the speech and sending people to the Capitol, you know, months before he would sit down with Carl and defend those people who were calling for the blood of the vice president, this is the form that that pressure came in. And it looks honestly like, as a country, we've decided that, you know, we didn't love it. We would prefer not to have the president doing that sort of thing, but there will be no consequences. This might be our last chance as a country to second guess that, to get a second opinion on whether insurrections are bad and there should be some sort of consequences. We'll see. Mark Meadows is going to be called in to testify. We will see if they're able to do that, if they actually press the legal case against him. But he clearly does know something at least about this effort to pressure Pence. And you know, it's even easy to conceive potentially that he did this himself, or it was just a result of Jenna Ellis pressuring him. But it's possible that him sending that to Pence came about as a result of conversations that he had with Donald Trump. It'll be very interesting to find that out. We have something else interesting for you, a little development. Brett Ehrlich joins us on the show now. Hey, Brett, how's it going?
Hey, what up, man? It's hey. I jumped off an audience development meeting, threw on a flannel, didn't even have time to light the fire behind me, but I'm glad to be here, John.
It doesn't. Yeah. By the way, as I was telling the audience, we're having technical issues and we're having a lot of trouble getting Senator Nita Turner on. It is very nice of you to be here. You don't have to be here. I know you got a lot of things you got to do.
No, I watched the show. You were flailing, dude.
I was. No, that.
Oh,
that,
how am I like going to come just up pull with the words? Audience,
and they would confirm that. But anyway, I'm happy to have you here. And so I think that it's important that on a show like this, you have differences between the people on the show. So sometimes that'll come in the form of life experience or possibly ideological distinctions. Brett and I do sometimes argue. He did call me a loser on Friday's show. But here, the major difference is going to be that I know what's on the rundown and he has no idea.
I know what's on your rundown, John.
Do you? Okay. Yes,
I do know exactly what's on your rundown. I looked at it earlier today. I was sifting through it just in the event. I like to come up with backup plans.
Nice.
But I will say, with all honesty, my performance on your show has very little to do with whether or not I have read through the stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I can prepare very intensely. Come up with cogent points, but you know this. When I get on your show, word vomit, incoherence, desperation, just trying to appeal
attacks
for people to love. Now that thing you're pointing out, John, I said your argument was a loser.
Okay, stop. Let's move on. I'm just joking. I'm trying to get a rise out of you.
Harp on it consistently. Anyway. Now you're kind of verging into
being a loser, honestly. Okay, no. So let's move off of that and let's talk about Laura Ingraham and her thing. I'm kidding. Anyway, I'm just trying to get rise out of you. Okay, so here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna keep on with more of the January 6th stuff. We're gonna see what happens. Brett, you stay on as long as you want. If you just leave at some point, I'll realize that. So don't worry. You just do what you gotta do. Anyway, with that, let's jump into this next story. Sorry, I mean the next part of that first story. Actually, I apologize. We're not going on to B. We're still on A. I'm just gonna reset for this. I'm a mess. Brett, you said I was flailing. You could not be more wrong. Anyway, there was a lot of talk of the 25th Amendment throughout the course of Donald Trump's years, generally coming from people outside of his administration, wishing that after one or another of the insane either comments or Sharpie marks on a whiteboard or seemingly treasonous activities, that his cabinet would do the right thing and remove him from power. That never seemed to have any chance of actually happening. But it turns out that at one point, there was apparently a little bit of talk inside of the administration of that happening. This is coming about, as so many bits of news are this week, from ABC News' Jonathan Carl, who reports that in the aftermath of January 6th, during which five people died, at least two cabinet secretaries asked Mike Pence, who'd been holed up in the Capitol as rioters were hunting for him, to convene a cabinet meeting to discuss it. Pence did not do so. So let's just bear that in mind. No matter how many of the threats were coming Pence's way on the 6th, in the wake of the 6th, he will never do anything to oppose Donald Trump. But the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talked to other cabinet members about using the 25th Amendment that night on the 6th, the day of the attack. He also brought it up the next day too. And Carl reports that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State at that point, asked for a legal analysis of the process for invoking the 25th Amendment. Carl writes that the analysis determined that it would take too much time, considering that Trump only had 14 days left in office and any attempt to forcefully remove him would be subject to legal challenge, which, look, it makes sense. And it doesn't seem as if you should be able to remove the president in like 5 minutes. But seemingly, it's supposed to be like the last resort if the president has totally lost it. And now we're learning, no, it would still take weeks, I guess. So let's hope he never gets like, I don't know, trigger happy with the nukes or anything, Brett.
My vague recollection of the significance of the 25th Amendment is like if the president has been shot in the head and no longer do the neurons work, or let's say they're slightly more down the road of whatever was happening to Reagan than Reagan when it was happening. I love that. I love these guys checking in because it's definitely symbolic of the relationship that they had, obviously, when Trump was president. You have people like Mnuchin who are like, listen, I'm actually in the wealthy class of people, and wealthy people respect and admire me. And I'm only here to have you in power as long as you give tax breaks to my kind of people. Yeah. And all those folks definitely do have like secure footing against the dissolution of America as we know it. And a lot of them are looking into ways to end it. But they don't get any credit, or as Anna says, they don't get any cookies, because it took until that moment when they realized that democracy was about to fall apart. And I don't think it, you know, I'm not saying that they needed to step up and remove the president for that reason, apart from all others, or at all. I think along the way, they needed to stand up and fight against the attack on democracy that he had launched in essence and repeatedly throughout his entire presidency. It's just like there they find themselves, you know, like super hot frogs in slowly boiling water.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, but as you point out, kind of frogs that see other frogs in hot water because they're not really feeling the heat necessarily. Like, I think people like Mnuchin would probably be perfectly happy with someone like Biden in office, assuming that they didn't raise taxes, they didn't increase government spending. They don't want the world to be riven by crazy maniacs. They just also don't want a single cent ever to be taken away from them in any way. And look, I think you're right. This is at the end of the day all about cookies, because it's not about consequences. Like, nothing's gonna happen to Trump based on this. So what you have is belated information, thanks to people like Jonathan Karl, who have so many of these bits of information and wait so long for us to find out about it. And so then we have to evaluate, so is Mnuchin better now? Pompeo was asking about it. Is that a good thing for Pompeo? Hey, Betsy DeVos and Elaine Chao might have supported the 25th supposedly, but they both resigned. So we'll never know. So are we supposed to be like impressed? Or this last little bit of information. When Secretary of Defense Mark Esper told Jonathan Karl that his goal was to prevent the use of the military against American citizens during the quote, the days before, the day of, and the days after the election, saying that he was worried that Trump was gonna use the Insurrection Act to send the military all over the country because of the protests. And remember, like, I think the insurrection took up a lot of the oxygen that previously had been focused on. There were months where Trump was regularly saying that he was going to send troops to Portland and stuff, and to Buffalo or whatever. People were being grabbed off the street and thrown into, you know, Kias and things like that. So he's saying, I was very worried about this. Trump was gonna do it. I was focused on stopping it. So do we take that seriously? Is it opportunistic? Does he get cookies? What do you think?
No, none of them get cookies. Mm-hmm. None of them get cookies. I mean, Esper's the one, I guess, who gets some kind of cookies, like the generals who sat there. But like, when you find yourself relying on the generosity of generals, like, that's when you know it's a giant mistake. And a lot of them, you know, I know he's defense secretary, but like that arm protecting us from the president's use of crazy force. Like, you look at how countries devolve into chaos and insanity. And honestly, it sucks, because like, I looked at these stories and I thought to myself this morning, like, ugh, I don't want to do it today, not today. But I don't know if that's responsible, because there's so many damn stories about January 6th, which are, you know, season one of Game of Thrones. You're like, oh my God, that's awesome. Like, but this feels like season five of like the third time a different studio tried to find some kind of property vaguely fantasy based like Game of Thrones. And they think the through line is just do the craziest stuff.
Sure.
And I'm desensitized to it and sad, but like that is also, and I've said this for years on your show, like part of what makes like dictators so effective and gives them their power is that they're crazy and they do insane things that are so off the charts. And to be someone who is a president of the United States, where like not even Mitch McConnell, not even half the other people, not even the crazies of the crazies were like, all right, let's do this.
let's do a coup. Let's do whatever we got to do. And not let the, you know, the peaceful transfer of power, the one thing that Americans typically like say, oh, you know, that's a bridge too far if you want to stop the peaceful transfer of power. None of them stepped up until the last minute, and they knew this is where it was headed. And Trump always was, whether it's him nakedly pursuing power or just seeing where his boundaries are like a child, like he's going to keep going. You have to do something about it.
Yeah. No, you're right. You have made the point about the craziness for a while. And I think we have tried consciously for years to try to ward off the normalization of every insane thing that you can imagine and lots of things that you couldn't. That only works so hard. Like, you know, some of the fellowship knew that the ring was trying to corrupt them. That doesn't mean they can resist it. Like, we, there are things that have been normalized for us. We've covered three of these stories here on our A block. I covered one or two more in the pre-show, but there was a bunch of others that have come out in the past day or two that we're not going to get to, and we're going to move on. Remember, you know, when a congressman had a video of him murdering AOC, that's gone from the news. So, like, it sucks that these things get normalized, because it's not just history. Trump is not done. I wish that he was, but he's not. And again, it really comes down to cookies, because it's not coming down to consequences. Esper will probably never testify about this. Maybe Meadows will, but Trump is still going to be able to run, and he is still as eager to regain power through whatever means possible or necessary. Okay. We're going to take our first break and see what's going on out there in the audience. We've got a lot of other news to get to, though, so don't go anywhere. Anyway, okay, everybody, we've got more to talk about. And so what better story to transition into a conversation with Brett with than a story I very specifically chose for Nina Turner? Anyway, so we're going to see. But Brett is a very clever individual, and he's going to hit the ground running. Okay, we're going to talk about this. They probably
be the most popular story of all time.
Exactly. Things are not going well for Joe Biden, and I would make the case that it's not particularly difficult to figure out why. But there are a few little wrinkles, little nuances to this that I want you to understand. This is not just a thing where we're talking about his approval rating, which is down. The Republicans are doing very well, like kind of historically well, in what's called like the generic congressional ballot. So right now, if elections were held today, and thankfully they're not, 46% of adults overall would back the Republican candidate for Congress. 43% would support the Democratic candidate. Among registered voters, which is obviously, you know, a more important metric, 51% go for the GOP to 41% for the Democrats. A historically strong result for Republicans on this measure. And so I want to, before I throw it to Brett, I want to add on a few more things to that. So there's a 10-point gap that's already historic. That is despite the fact that the Republicans lost both the White House and the Senate just less like 1 year ago, and tried to overthrow the government less than 1 year ago, completely botched the pandemic response, and all of that. That's all now ancient history. America has moved on. Are they not merciful? And Brett, they are really interested in the Republicans these days. What do you think?
They don't like people in power. That's super American, and we can get really excited about it. We don't like authority and people in power. What's most interesting to these kinds of things to me is, like, as I'm trying to wade through the consequences of this, you know, the implications of this poll, I keep thinking to myself, like, what is the voice of leadership on the left? Who in Congress, who in the White House is fighting back against the onslaught of negative narratives out there? No one in the White House is defending the president, least of all the president of the United States. Nancy Pelosi, when she goes out and tries to speak, it's the hand goes higher, but the points are never raised. She's like, you know, you got, and doesn't make a single goddamn bit of sense.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, on the right, everything's getting defined. Every rhetorical debate is getting framed by the right. And you can take your pick as to what the problem is. I would say probably the biggest problem is Democratic infighting has become like the replacement for dysfunctional DC, which is true to a certain extent. But then you add on to that the media's framing, even like perceived as leftward leaning media framing, the media outlets are framing it as, and then you know they pass these giant spending bills that cause inflation. And everyone's just sitting there going like, nothing got tangibly better for me. I know that Trump's out of power, but that doesn't mean I like the Democrats.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And even insofar as that they passed a bill, I think the accurate perception that some people come away with, if they know anything that's in the bill, is that that is not the bill that was most focused on benefiting them. That the parts that were intended of either or both of the bills that were intended to benefit them have been stripped away or shrunk. And in terms of the actual effect that these bills will have on people, you know, it is a bill over 10 years. So it's not like in the first 3 months, huzzah, everything's gonna be great. Now, what could help to bridge that gap between when the bill is passed and when it's actually the provisions have kicked in and they're benefiting people are if the Democrats were united in saying, we were put into power to do this, we're gonna do it, that might help to reassure people. But we didn't have that. We had months and months of Sinema and Manchin and a few others making a mess of the process. We still don't know if the better of the two bills will literally ever pass. And so, yeah, the idea that DC is dysfunctional, like it's difficult to rebut, it is clearly true.
And meantime, there's another front getting opened by the Republicans, which is it isn't even critical race theory, because critical race theory is just a buzzword. The framing of critical race theory is these big government teachers organizations or these big government like school boards in lockstep with teachers unions that take resources and choice away from parents continue to take resources and choice away from parents. And there is no counter narrative out there at all, except what the Republicans have at least neutralized to a certain extent, which is, well, if you don't like it, you're racist. And the Republicans have cut their losses and just been like, we're gonna get enough, like, I'm tired of hearing about it, white people, to be like, stop calling me racist.
Totally.
And yeah, just turn off. And,
well, look, and you were talking before about Biden and congressional leaders too, including Nancy Pelosi. So the issue is like really twofold. These are not the people to really make the case and prosecute the case over the course of months or perhaps years, because fundamentally they don't have what I would argue is the right positions on these issues necessarily. But even if they did, they're not good messengers for these things. Like, you know, I had issues, a lot of people had issues with Obama on substance. He could go out there and campaign though, at least. Biden can't do that. If you gave Biden like your preferred list of talking points, he'd be a bad person to actually push for them. So if it's not gonna be them, who is it going to be? Well, the Democratic Party is not going to allow it to be the squad or Bernie or whoever. So what is it supposed to be like the 2024 hopefuls? Is it supposed to be Harris and Buttigieg? Well, Harris is not doing well at all in the polls. Yeah. She's seemingly disappeared. Buttigieg, like, is not going to do well. We already went through this. I don't understand. So
dude, they're still trying. There is a literal,
I know.
Yeah, they're trying so hard. And the right has, everybody's going after Kamala Harris.
Yeah, well, we're gonna turn to that actually in a minute. Yeah. You're 100% right. And so like the polling is terrible for the Democrats, but even if it wasn't, remember the Democrats can't just break even. They can't win by 1 point and hold power because of how manipulated the system is at like 30 different levels. So if they're polling badly and you have all of that, the stuff that was baked in, the inequities of the system before, and by the way, the redistricting update, which we're gonna just gloss over this a bit, but the Republicans have added at least 5 seats, which means that the Republicans, if they were no more popular than they were in 2020, would take control of Congress. But they are more popular. So all of this is lining up to potentially doom the Democrats. And the Democrats don't seem to have the willingness or the ability to turn it around. And I will just quickly jump out in front of the one person who's gonna leave a comment. It's like, yeah, and I bet you'd still tell us to vote for him, right? Well, I would say to you and the million other people who think exactly the same way, if you would like to make the case for why Republicans gaining political power in the US is better for progressives, then you should effing do that. Instead of trying to lead people to that position without ever having to actually say why that would be good. Yes, the Democrats blow in a lot of different ways. They're wrong on substance, they're terrible messengers. They're still better than allowing the fascists to take over. That was true in 2016 and 2020. It remains true. And if you'd like to argue for why fascists controlling the US government would be better specifically for progressives, then that's on you to do. Anyone can upload videos to YouTube. Feel free to turn on your camera. But anyway,
Brett,
I'm just so sick and stupid. Like, yes, I understand. It is sometimes appealing to people who've been through a lot of years of difficult news to try to tell them that they can just check out. That they don't have to actually be a part of the solution. That doing literally nothing and just allowing insane people to run amok, that sure is easier, right? Than staying invested. Is it gonna work? Is it gonna make the country better, the world better? I don't see how it could, and you're not making the case for why it would. Anyway, apparently my monitor has been blocking part of the show, and why not today of all days?
I could, Brett, with the monitor where it was, I couldn't see the wooden beam behind it. So
how dare you? I like.
It's interesting. It's an interesting framing. I was thinking about it. I was definitely staring at it because I noticed it. But you were in the middle of a thing. I didn't want to interrupt your thing.
Anyway, I got a little bit mad there. It was really my fault. It didn't need to happen. And now we're about to transition into Tucker Carlson. So it's about to get worse. So let's jump into this video.
John,
Wait. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that argument was a winner.
Thank you. Am I a winner?
No.
Not necessarily.
I
get how this works. Okay. Well, in that case, now let's move into that video.
So the one thing we know for sure about Kamala Harris is we should all be very, very grateful to have her because she's historic for reasons that no one ever explains. But there's a lot we don't know about Kamala Harris. Most people probably don't know she really grew up in Canada. That's where she went to high school. She's not from this country in that sense, or she's certainly also from Canada. Okay.
This is like the most watched guy in cable news. And we just played you a little bit of that video. We're gonna play you more. That is the least crazy part of the video, by the way, Brett. But I would say, what is he trying to accomplish? I think that broad strokes, we could just say he is fostering and encouraging just a resentful, condescending attitude towards the vice president. And that's pretty much it. But let's briefly talk about some of what he said there. So what do we know about her? Well, the one thing we know is that she's supposed to be historic for reasons nobody can explain. Look, if you don't think that diversity for diversity's sake is a net good, okay, make that case. But what do you mean nobody has explained how it's historic to have a female vice president or a black vice president or a multiracial vice president, a Southeast Asian vice president? I feel like people have explained that, Brett.
Tucker Carlson's show is a crispy sock. Do you know what I mean?
No.
You're gonna hate it, John.
Okay.
To invoke a line from Bridesmaids, you can crack it in half. Because it's a place where the white supremacist, like, I don't want to think, I want to feel superior, I'm crotchety, I'm angry, I need to blow off some steam. They turn on that tube sock and they masturbate into it over and over and over and over again. And it gets so full of the residue of their chronic scornography that they can snap that show in half. Tucker Carlson doesn't make any sense, historical for reasons we can't explain. This is Tucker being like, someone please say race so I can say, you guys are all, oh, it's always about race with you people. It's a female, it's historical. No one's saying it's like, this is the end all be all of human existence. Yes. It's just, you're going to gaslight me so hard that you're going to deny that America has never had a female vice president. That's what you're saying to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's the only thing. And then Tucker went to school in Switzerland.
Wait,
Tucker Carlson went to the Collège de Le Mans boarding school in Switzerland. Until according to him, he says he got kicked out. So Tucker Carlson is not from this country.
In that sense.
In that sense.
And he just wants us to say, London, you're not from the US. In that sense, what does that even mean? She went to school. That's not changing your citizenship. What are you talking about?
It's like when people who don't understand journalism just kind of vaguely know they can get sued if they don't say allegedly. His in that sense is just allegedly.
His whole show is allegedly. And by the way, what are you talking about that you don't get? Like, first of all, you don't get how she's supposed to be historic. That is so condescending. In this case, not towards Kamala Harris or towards us, but towards their audience. Because their audience should be like, wait. I mean, look, I don't care if she's black. I don't care if she's Asian. But like, that's definitely why they're saying she's historic. But anyway, Winsome Sears, first woman of color to be lieutenant governor in Virginia. They were talking about that like 2 weeks ago. What are you talking about that you don't understand why diversity is good? You just don't care about it because it's Kamala Harris. But anyway, as I said, that was the least weird and creepy section of it. And technically, it's running a close second to Brett's whole thing there. But anyway, here is more of that video.
Well, that doesn't mean she's not going to be a good vice president, but why haven't we heard that? By the way, how did someone who clearly is not liked by the people around her and clearly isn't very good at her job get so high up? Well, we know her first meaningful job in politics was given to her by her boyfriend at the time, who's married, Willie Brown. Most powerful Democrat in California. But we know that Willie Brown is not the only powerful person she dated. And this is pretty interesting. We're not exactly sure what to make of it. But it turns out that Kamala Harris also dated the tabloid TV show host Montel Williams, who's always doing shows about people's weird sex lives. We know that. So we know that Montel Williams called her Kamala. We also know she calls herself Kamala sometimes. But that's kind of all we know. So what was that relationship like? What did Montel Williams think of it? So we would love to talk to Montel Williams about his torrid relationship with Kamala or Kamala, because that might be one of those blanks we'd like to fill in. Anyway, he is always welcome on this show. Meantime, we know that Kamala Harris having some problems as vice president.
So, quick note that he pronounced her name like 5 different times. And I don't mean when he's specifically trying to say that because he thinks he heard her say it one way, that means he gets to. Literally just when he's referring to her, he says it multiple different ways in the middle of the same segment. And that's the only thing that he knows about her, despite the fact that she's been vice president for a year, was a senator for literally years, held multiple state offices, had a torrid affair. Why was it a torrid affair? She dated him. That's what you know. Why was it torrid in that case? Who invented the torrid thing, Brett? Look, Brett, it's so deeply weird. So deeply weird that a guy with an audience of literally millions who makes like what, $20 million a year? Just did a whole segment about the vice president that was weirder than anything we've ever said on Common Room about anyone. What are your thoughts?
First of all, thanks for the compliment on Common Room.
Thank you.
Tucker Carlson is trying to say that somebody else has ill-gotten gains due to their connections.
Mm-hmm.
Tucker Swanson Broth Carlson. Tucker, son of Dickie Carlson, television anchor in the second biggest television reporter in the second biggest market in America.
Yeah.
That guy's going to go after other people for their connections. That's the Willie Brown angle. And yeah, sure, people that, fine, we can talk about that. Montel Williams is an attempt to what? Besmirch a political figure's reputation by because they were at one point connected to trash TV. Mm-hmm. Like Donald Trump starred in trash TV. You're talking about people that he dated along the way, like Stormy Daniels. Like what are you? The double standards are so ridiculous and stupid. The truth is, he's got a whole bunch of guys, and this is the stuff that there's just bait so someone could say the very true thing so he can act shocked by it, which is like, she's a woman. You hate it. You hate that there's a powerful woman. You hate it so damn much. You've got to call her a whore. That's what you're doing. You're calling her a whore. You're saying she did sex things in exchange for favors, money, power, fame, all of that. You're saying she slept her way to the top. That's what you're saying. And you're saying that because you can't handle the fact that a woman got stuff, period. And it's okay. And you're gonna go like, no, you guys, oh, why is it always race with you guys? Why is it always sex with you guys? It's like, you started it, and B, you know I'm right. You absolutely know I'm right, period, full stop. No other part of that conversation. So shut the up.
That's all it is. That's all it is. And he knows that that's what his audience wants. But some people might be watching this and thinking, wait, why are you guys defending Kamala Harris in this way? I would argue we're defending like rationality and perhaps some sort of base level of civility in the media. Not Kamala Harris specifically. I'm not saying that she's an awesome VP or anything like that. The reason I wanted to cover this was one, to point out how weird it is that we've elevated this rich a-hole to be like the biggest guy in media. But more importantly, why did he just do that whole segment? That's the final point that I'm gonna make. Because I think, and we've done this in the past, there are all sorts of ways that you could criticize or even attack Kamala Harris if you wanted to do that. But what you need to understand is that Tucker Carlson is not free to use basically any of those criticisms. Tucker Carlson is not gonna criticize her for her past California level positions of being way too tight with the police and deferential to what they want, because he wants that same thing. He's not gonna criticize her as being corrupt, as being bought by donors and just delivering on the agenda they want. Because while that's potentially true, he doesn't want you thinking about politicians being bought, because it's easy to then move to other Democrats and then to Republicans and then maybe even to right-wing media figures. He doesn't want you thinking about any of that. What is she doing in terms of using her position as VP to really deliver for the American people? He doesn't really want you thinking about that either, because he doesn't want you having the expectation that politicians should actually deliver for you. So he has to find a way to criticize her, but he can't touch any of the substance because he doesn't want his audience thinking about substance literally ever. And so it has to be about Montel Williams and Torrid Affairs and how you pronounce her name and whether if you went to high school somewhere you're no longer a United States citizen and all sorts of nonsense like this. This is why they love the stuff about Hunter Biden, and they focus on these sorts of things because they do not want their audience thinking about the obligation that your government officials have to actually deliver, to represent you and not their donors. And so you get really weird segments like this when you know you need to attack the first female vice president, the first black female vice president, the first mixed race, all of those things, but you can't do it on any of the substance. So we will criticize her. We're not defending her. I don't owe Kamala Harris anything. I don't care about Kamala Harris, but I do want us to have media that's actually gonna focus on the substance of these politicians. That's going to make their lauding of certain politicians, if you're gonna do that, and their attacks against others based on the actual substance. But Tucker Carlson can't do that. It's always gonna be creepy, weird nonsense like this, because he is effectively in a straitjacket when it comes to the real substance of government. Any quick final thoughts, Brett, before we move on to our last story?
Yeah, Ted Cruz is from Canada, literally. John McCain was born in the Canal Zone. Mitt Romney's father was born in Mexico. Like, that never stopped them before. They're all about it. Period. It's a double standard. It's stupid.
Okay, very briefly, let's jump into this one last story with the time we have with Brett, who's so nice. A teacher in New York was told to not wear some of his, we'll just say propaganda t-shirts. We'll let you judge if that's what they are. But he had been wearing shirts that said "Back the Blue" and "Proud Zionist" to school, and he was told not to. And that has led to this back and forth about what sorts of slogans are acceptable and which are not. This is Jeffrey Levy, who teaches at William Alexander Middle School 51 in Brooklyn, New York. So he has lodged a complaint to the Department of Education about what he is saying is anti-Semitism, because his shirt choice is being controlled. Well, he says others are not. There are teachers who've worn shirts supporting feminism and the Black Lives Matter movement. And let's see, there was this email exchange between the principal and this teacher where the principal told Levy, he gave him a verbal warning that the politics you expressed via your t-shirts had led to students feeling unsafe and uncomfortable, in that it was triggering due to the politics expressed. Levy said he was just as offended by Black Lives Matter's that organization and offended by the LGBTQ community. So he said the shirts and the flags should be removed if his are gonna be. So this is covering a lot of different political territory, Brett, but what do you think?
Uniforms. I loved uniforms just because I had no fashion sense and it was great. Teachers should wear uniforms. Screw it. It's like when someone puts on a black, and maybe this is just us communicating, and then I'd like someone from that side to come back at me in a way that like makes sense. But like, I feel like if you put on a Black Lives Matter shirt, you're just like, I just want to remind everybody that like there's an overlooked part of society and Black Lives Matter. When you put on that like Zion till I die in shirt, like back the blue, like you're a like angry and triggered and you're trying to make a point counter to the one made by someone who just came out and was like, I'm cool. I just want to point out something good, something positive to think about in the world. And there's a difference between those things. I'd say on the merits, like if you're banning that guy's shirt, just I'm fine with banning all political whatever in a school for reasons that make sense, where you ban like showing of pornography in schools, you ban, there's certain kind of restricted speech in schools, because the whole point of school is to like draw a line around like, here's what we're going to teach kids right now. And that's what we're focusing on. We're getting rid of distractions. Like, I'm fine getting rid of all of those things in the school. Just put it outside and just focus on teaching kids.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of like, I want teachers to be invested in what's going on. I just wish that we could do that in a country where we have rational people that aren't awful, and we don't. I don't know, like it's complicated. I want teachers to be supportive of marginalized groups and things like that. It's just that they seem to think that the police are the marginalized group. And we know what they mean when they wear these things. These are not about backing the blue. These are about opposing something that's not blue. That's what it's about. Also, as many people are pointing out, why is a teacher wearing a t-shirt anyway? What's going on with the casual Fridays approach to elementary school in this place? It's like mildly controversial when I go on the main show in just a t-shirt. Why are teachers doing that? You're like a professional. You should be wearing something. I don't know. Aren't you supposed to have like tweed patches or something? But anyway, I just look, it clearly is bothering some of the students. I'm assuming the end result will be something like what you've said, Brett, but we're going to have to see. In any event, we are regrettably out of time. Brett, thank you for joining us. I hope that it at least felt like the time flew by. You are just the best around.
Thank you. You too, John. Have an excellent day.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, well, we still have more news coming. So if you're on Twitch, YouTube, the members app, we're going to take a short break, just a couple of minutes, but we'll be back with more after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.